This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner. It's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for today's interview episode with David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
David, today we have the first of a handful of interviews that we managed to conduct before SAG-AFTRA went on strike. It is a really strange time in Hollywood. But honestly, I can't imagine a better person to talk to through all of this than Anjanou Ellis, who you talked to this week.
One of my favorites to talk to. We got to know each other a little bit during the King Richard press tour. Listeners may remember she was on the show back then.
Was it a delight then? And is it a delight now? Yes.
Absolutely. And a very candid interview as well.
Yeah.
You know, she's someone who is a SAG member. We spoke about the strike and she was very open about her feelings about why at that point they were about to go on strike and why they are now on strike.
But she's also got a show that's really worth talking about. You know, she's not allowed to promote her work now, but this interview was conducted before. And I think we would very happily sing the praises of her work in Justified City Primeval.
Absolutely. I was a big Justified fan back when it aired on FX. It hasn't been too long since it ended its run. But I'm always wary of reboots. We all are. I think this one does a really smart job of respecting what made the show great, familiar, while giving it a little bit of a new energy, which mostly has to do with the location. It's set in Detroit, and it finds Raylan, the marshal, played by Timothy Oliphant, who's the protagonist of the show, in a new environment. He's a fish out of water. And one of his main foils is a lawyer, played by Anjanou Ellis, who is defending... he's known as the Oklahoma Wild Man, who is the main antagonist played by Boyd Holbrook. And she's a very savvy and conflicted character who crosses paths with him in more ways than one.
So you guys talked about SAG. You guys talked about Justified a little bit. Any other highlights to tease for people?
I thought this was a good time to catch up with her because, first of all, the role is great. And it's the kind of showcase that I think represents her new status in Hollywood a little bit, but she's about to have a huge 12 months or so, assuming the release calendar does not go completely in flux because of everything going on. But she's filmed some really exciting projects. She's the lead of the new film directed by Ava DuVernay, which is adapted from the book Cast. She is a core part of The Nickel Boys, which is adapted from Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer-winning novel. And that film she describes as, in ways that I did not expect and that are very exciting. And just generally, she's leaning into the fact that she's a pretty in-demand actor right now and is getting the kinds of roles she wasn't just a few years ago.
I love it when someone gets a post-Oscar bump like that and you get to catch them really just seizing all the opportunities that come their way.
Indeed.
Well, let's hear your conversation, once again recorded before the strike began, with Anjanou Ellis.
Anjanou Ellis, you're here to talk about Justified City Primeval. You're a new cast member. This feels to me, though, like the first of many, many things that you have coming up, which I'm pretty excited about.
Right. Oh, it's so funny. Like last year, after the awards, I went from back to back to back and started. It started with Justified,
right?
And it didn't stop until March of this year, where I was just like, you know, back to back to back to back today. And I'm not complaining. I was like, I need all these checks, so thank you very much.
You'll take it. You'll take it.
I will take it all.
I'm curious, like, as a starting point, what appealed to you about this part in Justified? Like, being familiar with your career, I thought it was pretty cool to see you get introduced in the courtroom, giving a badass speech, knowing you've done a lot of guest spots on these kinds of shows. You've played the defendant many times, and here you're kind of get to be the one taking charge a little bit.
Yeah, someone asked me about that, and they're like, well, you know, your Law and Order experience. And I was like, I don't know. No, I was a defendant. I was a defendant. Right. I'm always at the table, but I'm the one about to go to jail.
Yep.
So I've observed, but not been the officer of the law.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So what did it feel like to kind of get to own that space a little bit this time? You're coming in as, I'd say, an actor with a different kind of profile, stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, I liked it. I liked it. And I loved, you know, that first courtroom scene particularly because, you know, she was, you know, challenging this, you know, Raylan Givens, mm-hmm. Who, you know, just thinks he can do whatever he wants. And I love the idea of being someone who says to an officer of the law that, no, you can't do that. I won't allow that. You're acting in a way that's abusive. And I'm calling you out on it. And I'm calling you out on it in this very public space. And I thought it was dope that the writers wanted to explore that, wanted to challenge him. So it was cool to be able to say that to a police officer or at least an officer of the court. And you know what I mean? In that way. Because that's what I want to say to police officers all the time. You know what I mean? So I get to say it.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. What was your familiarity with Justified before? And, like, what expectations did you have about kind of volleying with Timothy Oliphant, who very seamlessly steps back into this role that he made pretty iconic a while back?
Yeah, there's kind of, I like that you use the word seamless. Like, there's sort of like no beginning and no end. You know what I mean?
yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I hadn't seen the series. I've seen just little, you know, bits and pieces of it. But of course, you know, because it's so, at this point, iconic, that character that he plays and Justified. So it was just in the ether. So I knew about it without having watched it. And yeah, I try not to have expectations, and I intentionally did not watch it when I was, you know, getting ready to do the job, and I didn't read the book because I'm such a book nerd that I will come into something carrying those assumptions, mm-hmm. you know, this is how it should be. And I didn't want to do that. You know, I wanted to be my mind to be free and open to that, this world that Raylan was entering, which was my world, which is Detroit, you know? Yeah. So I wanted to be able to feel free to play with that without any presumptions. And the great thing about working with Tim, at least in this situation, you know, it's the only one I know, is that he's open to what you bring.
Yeah. You've had a lot, this show has had a lot of great different kinds of actors over the years. And I remember when I saw you were cast, I wondered what kind of energy you'd be able to bring to the show. And I have to say, I was surprised by, I think it's safe to call a little bit of flirtatious energy between you and Tim. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
It did surprise me.
Okay.
It did surprise me. You know, you use the word surprise. Surprise is a perfect word. Okay. I was not expecting that at all.
I'm loving your smile right now. I hate that this is a podcast so people can't see it.
Because that's how I was like, wait, what?
There is a Yellowstone Kevin Costner reference in the first episode that I won't recite here, but it made me laugh.
Oh,
between
yeah.
you and another character.
Yes, yes, yes.
In relation to that. Yes. So let's talk a little bit about this character of Carolyn. How exactly did you figure her out? Like, you mentioned this being more of your world, you can feel in these opening episodes kind of ownership of space in this community and her protecting people she's close to, for instance. What drew you to her?
I think that's what drew me to her.
Yeah.
You know, is that she doesn't act as an individual, you know, that she brings the weight of the city with mm-hmm. her. And she feels protective of it against Raylan. And I think that makes, for me, an interesting clash.
Yeah.
An interesting collision between these two folks. And the other thing about her that I loved is that what is most important for her is not the law, it's justice.
Yes.
And I think that for the two of them, justified, that I think that is the gravity a little bit, you know, that there is the law, which is the job, but there is justice. And oftentimes those things don't converge.
Yeah.
They don't meet. And I think she, you know, she carries herself in a way and is prepared to do what it takes to protect the people in her life, even if it's not necessarily legal.
Right.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You and I talked about King Richard a few years ago, and one thing I was struck by was the way you talked about really protecting and advocating for Oracine and her voice to be a big part of that movie. I'm curious, coming into this project, you know, you mentioned this being your people, your community. Like, did you feel a level of comfort, a level of needing to advocate for certain things, elements in the story and character?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you have to do that. I think women always have to do that, period. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, there's certain things as, you know, as a Black woman, I work with some very talented writers. Those showrunners and those producers of that show, they are special. They are special at what they do, but they don't know everything, you know? They're writing a Black woman, but this character wasn't written originally as a Black woman. Elmore Leonard didn't imagine her as a Black woman. So there are things that and insight that I have that they don't necessarily have as white dudes, mm-hmm. you know? And the great thing is that they listen to me. You know, we had to go to battle for a few things, and sometimes I won. Most of the time, they listen, because they wanted it to be something that people would watch and not feel disrespected by.
Yeah.
So, thankfully, they were open. You know,
I was thinking about that. Just the setting of Detroit and a real immersion into it to an extent is not something you see in popular TV, especially very often. Shows that have a built-in audience as this one does.
Yeah, you know, and I like the idea that, you know, Raylan essentially is a fish out of water here.
Yeah.
You know, and he meets all these, you know, all these crazy characters.
Unique characters, yeah.
And we have to watch him try to figure out how to be.
Yeah.
And how to get what he wants, how to protect his kid in this mad, mad world.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit to the moment you were talking about when offers like this started coming in. What did that feel like? What was that experience after your Oscar nomination for King Richard, that period of what seemed to me, just based on deadline headlines, a big excitement?
Well, you know, what's funny is that a couple of things happened before the nomination. I got this Justified offer before the nomination happened. Oh. It actually happened the fall of 2022. I don't remember, but yeah, it happened before the nomination. A couple other things happened before the nomination, so it felt like these things were happening after I got nominated, but in reality, right, you know, they were coming down a, you know, pipe anyway. But listen, I was happy. I didn't care.
whenever it came. In terms of, you mentioned kind of carrying that book sometimes, I was struck by the amount of projects you have that are like pretty seminal books coming up. Like, mm-hmm, you have Colson Whitehead's The Nickel Boys, you have Cased, which Ava DuVernay is adapting. Did you immerse yourself into those books?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think that particularly with Cast, you know, I was familiar, of course, with Ms. Wilkerson.
Yes.
And had read a lot of The Warmth of Other Suns, or mm-hmm, the first book I think she won the Pulitzer for. But I had not read Cast. I had seen interviews that she did about it, but I had not read the book. And then when I found out that, you know, Ava was, you know, going to make it into a film, and I kind of came in late in the process. I think she had been seeing people and, you know, had been further along in the process. And I heard about it and I was like, yo, I want to be, you know, I come, look at me. You, yeah, know what I mean? I fought for this. You know, I fought for that part. I fought, yeah, for that. I had to, I guess, get Ava to see me in a mm, way maybe that she hadn't thought of seeing me before. Mm. And I took a picture of Ms. Wilkerson and a screenshot of Ms. Wilkerson. And I took a picture of myself,
oh, wow,
dressed as Ms. Wilkerson and wearing similar clothing, mm, jewelry. And I sent it to Ava, the casting director, and I was able to, you know, become one of the people that they considered based on that.
Right.
I just refused to accept no, you know.
I love that.
And yeah, and it is, you know, for some, I think the gods, you know, they know that I'm a, you know, big book nerd, and for some reason they're like, okay, let's just take her experience away from just reading the book. Let's let her actually live these stories,
right,
that she reads.
Yeah, that's great. You had worked with Ava before, you know, there's obviously the confidence to be able to say, you know, consider me for this. But I wonder if also having worked with her before, you did feel a level of comfort maybe in putting yourself out there a little bit more.
No.
No.
I didn't, you know. I had worked with Ava, yes, on When They See Us a few years ago.
Emmy-nominated performance, I will add.
well, thank you. Thank you. I think that's one of the most important things I've ever done, just because of what happened as a result of that,
yeah,
piece of work being out in the world. So yeah, but I didn't, you know, that series was a cast of thousands, almost literally. I mean, New York being one of the member of the cast. So I was just, you know, we talked, but I didn't leave that experience feeling like, you know, I can just call Ava up, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I didn't feel like I could take anything for granted. So that's why, you know, I had to be like, let me fight for this a little bit.
Yeah. Can you talk to me about Nickel Boys a little bit, and particularly Colson Whitehead has been on such an extraordinary streak with these novels. I remember interviewing him for this one, actually, and it's a devastating story and devastating book. I'm curious what it was like to, again, be considered for that and then be a part of that world.
Yeah, though, I mean, it was just, I got to work with Jeremy Kleiner from Plan B. Mm-hmm. And he actually reached out to me, I think at first, about it. But the thing is that I really wanted to work with Ramel Ross, who's the director.
Right.
You know, that was a gravity for me, because I saw his documentary film, Hell County,
yeah,
which knocked
It's a brilliant me, documentary, yeah.
You know, knocked me out. Knocked me out. I saw it in Brooklyn, and it just it did something to me. And I actually, I was stalking him for a little while. He's a professor at Brown. So I called Brown. I was like, may I speak to Romero Ross, please?
Oh, I love it.
You know, I went to Brown, but I mean, you know, so right. What?
So what? It's a big school.
You know what I'm saying? And that was years ago. I was like, yeah, may I speak to Romero Ross, please? They're like, he's not here. So, you know, and I think I might have written him an email. I don't know, but I was on some Romero. I was all about Romero Ross. Right. And, you know, then Jeremy reached out to me about it. And I was just like, yo, I don't care what it is. I just want to work with this dude.
Yeah.
And I wasn't reaching out to him because I was like, I want you to give me a job. Because at that point, he was a documentary filmmaker. That's all that I knew that he was doing. I just wanted to tell him how I was affected by the work that I saw in that film. And then, you know, I was like, I don't care what he's doing. And I don't care how little or small, I just want to be a part of what he's doing. When I tell you Romero Ross is, he is extraordinary. He's extraordinary. I don't know what this film is going to be. I mean, it's one of the strangest things I've ever done, but I love doing strange stuff and I was there for it. I'm here for it.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited. I'm really excited for the world to see whatever it is. I'm excited.
I know you can't share too much, but what about it felt like different or new to you as a filming experience?
Well, I can't tell you because okay, it'll kind of give it away. But I will say this, is that his approach to the point of view of the characters is, I've only seen that in a film noir movie that I saw years and years ago, you know? Okay. And he sort of does something really innovative with the perspective of the protagonist. That's all I'll say.
All right. That's a cool tease.
If he hears this, he's going to be like, shut up!
That's a cool tease, though. I will take it.
Yeah.
That's more than I was expecting, to be honest with you.
It's he's special, man. Romero Ross. I have worked with a treasure trove in the last, you know, for a while.
Yeah. You have, and I think it's paid off. You know, watching Justified again, it's the kind of character I haven't really gotten to see you play before, at least at that level of profile. There's this moment in the third episode where we find out a new detail about your character, her ambition, really, what she wants to pursue in this show. And there's a moment where you walk into the courtroom, which is empty, and it's a silent scene, and you walk toward the bench and you sit in the judge's chair, and the camera just really holds on you. I thought it was such a powerful moment. I don't want to say it was like a metaphor for you or anything, but it did feel like, okay, there's a power here. I'm curious if it felt that way to you.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because we did so much of it out of order. A lot of it was done out of order. So we actually shot that, I mean, I think towards the end of it. So it's interesting that you're saying that it happened in the in the third episode. Yeah, you know, I love the fact that she is unapologetically ambitious. You know, she wants something. She wants something and feels like, I'm going to do what I got to do to make that happen. And I'm good. I'm good with the consequences of that, of whatever that looks like. And I love that.
Yeah.
We can love that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I consider you a pretty ambitious actor. Not to say you'll go to some of the lengths that this character does.
No. I'm not gonna step on anybody, but I do where I do feel like I work my ass off. I really do. I try to anyway, and I feel like she does that too, you know. But I think she sort of reached this point where it's like, I did all the right things, you know. I married the guy, you know, and he put me over, you know. I got the law degree. I did this. I did all the things. And I still look at where I am right now, and I think she's just fed up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Understandably, right? I'm gonna throw a quote back at you that you shared with me at the premiere of King Richard that moved me and surprised me. You said, I'm trying to accept something good without feeling like something bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm curious how you hear that, I guess, what is it, a year and a half later? Knowing the pretty extraordinary amount of projects you've gotten to work on, and also the fact that this was an opportunity that you could say paid off in the way it was supposed to pay off, in the way that this industry historically is supposed to work.
Yeah, I still feel that way. I still fight that demon, you know, like, you know, if something is too good, I look at my phone like this, like, okay, I'm waiting on the bad news. When is it going to happen? You know, and the reality is that, you know, sometimes it is, sometimes it has happened like that, where it's just like this tremendous, the week that I was nominated, you know, I lost somebody in my life, you know, but I also have to think of it like this too, David, is I have to start believing or acting in a way. When I say acting, I mean my personal behavior in a way that this is my life, as opposed to this is a miracle. It's a miraculous life, you know, but that this is my life and I work really hard for what is happening and has happened. I work my ass off for it, you know, and that this is a path that perhaps maybe I'm supposed to be on. Yeah. So maybe I should look at it like this is my professional life, you know, rather than this is a miracle. You just won the lottery again. You just won the lottery again. And I think, do you know how that's crazy? But I think that's how I've been looking at it. Like me winning the lottery 3-4 times in a row, as opposed to, no, this is your professional life. How do you maximize that? And then maybe it'll take all the witchery off of it, you know?
Yeah. I think it's very standard, honestly, for someone who's, you know, you've been fighting for that kind of place in this industry for a long time. And when it suddenly comes, it's like, wait, is this happening for real? Or is this a one-time thing?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I think the tempering of that is that there are these other things that I want equally, right? Mm. This other, you know, part of my creative life that I want to activate as strongly as this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is that, then that hasn't happened yet in the way that I would like it to. So that calms me down. That keeps me calm. It's like, yeah, this is great. I'm acting, you know, but I'm still someone else's employee. Yep. And I'm ready to be somebody's employer.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. Are we talking directing, producing? What are you willing to say about that?
Writing and producing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm nobody's director, but writing and producing, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah.
I remember one thing that was really important to you back in that Oscar campaign was living at home, essentially, going back home. You didn't live in Hollywood, I don't want to presume you still don't, but how have you found that balance of life and work as things have accelerated for you?
It's never been a question. It's never been balanced. It's never been balanced. I don't know people like that. If they exist, they probably, I don't know how else to say that, they probably have penises.
You knew I was sipping coffee right there.
I thought about that. Like, it might be a spit take on his part if I say that. But it's true. You know, like, I think when you're a woman, you know, I was a caregiver for my mother for a very long time. And there was no such thing as balance. I had a great, you know, I had some people that were there helping me do that. So when I had to go off and, you know, work, you know, they would take care of her. But yeah, you know, I made a decision about my life, you know, a few years ago. I guess if it's been about 11 or 12 years ago, you know, I knew that I was going to live in Mississippi. I made that decision. And so this is the decision I make. So how do I make this other stuff work around it? I had to choose that, though. You know, I didn't let my professional life make that choice for me. I decided where I wanted to be, where my family needed me to be, you know, and I'm happy. I'm glad.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Lastly, as we are in a strange period for this industry, I did want to briefly ask you about the potential actor strike, how you're feeling as a SAG member about where things are at, what you personally are fighting for. I, again, thought of you in shows like this as someone where residuals were probably pretty important. But yeah, go ahead. Anything that you're looking at here?
Yeah, it's utterly frustrating. You know, it's utterly frustrating. You know, it really is this sort of like the haves versus the have nots, you know, and just the incredible, you know, imbalance between folks who have most of the money and folks who don't have, you know, the money at all. And, you know, I have worked and did well this year and a half, but that's this year and a half, you know, and I have not made the amount of money that I made last year. I haven't made that because I'm working on, you know, a small indie movie, and that's not going to pay me what I got paid to do Justified, mm-hmm. you know? So there's a lot of inequity, you know, there's a lot of inequity, a lot of inequality, and that has to be addressed. And I just feel that there is just a lack of respect. There's a lack of respect for writers. There's a lack of respect for actors, you know? And then with the whole AI thing, you know, it's like, okay, if we're replacing people, you're going to replace the writers, you're going to replace the actors. Let's replace some directors. Let's replace some producers. You know what I mean? Since we're replacing folks, you know, if we have no value other than our image, you know,
yeah,
like who needs ultimately to be replaced? I feel that, you know, I'm standing with the WGA. I stand with SAG-AFTRA. And I'm probably going to hit the picket line today, actually, for a little bit.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back on Thursday with our roundtable conversation. In the meantime, find us at Vanity Fair on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider, and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich and David.
David Canfield, 97.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
the fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company,
and why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.